Welcome to what we think will soon become one of the most diverse radio shows and its website on the web. If you're interested in alternative medicine, metaphysics, alternative energies, UFOs, homeopathy, secret societies, abductions, science, wild food cookery, and many other interesting subjects, then this is the place for you. We hope you listen and participate in discussions with top experts in their respective fields as we grow together. We will try to be a source of knowledge and able to give you positive solutions and inspiration in order to positively better your life.
This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theofanos and Scott Jordan.
This is Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio, and my name is Tom Theofanos. Some of you may have heard of pirate radio that was being broadcasted back in offshore out in England back in the 60s. Well, my guest today is one of the original disc jockeys from the 60s on those ships, Errol Bruce Knapp. Welcome, Errol.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here. It Great. Feels just like radio again.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, all those years ago. It must have been 40-something years.
At least.
And you were just, what?
A little baby.
A twinkle in your daddy's eyeball?
A twinkle in my daddy's eyes, yes. So tell me more about this pirate radio. What was it about?
When I was very young in the UK, there was really only a couple of things to listen to. You either got to listen to BBC Radio. Boring. Or you listen to Radio Luxembourg out of the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, which came on in the evening, and the British record companies bought time there, and they had their own disc jockeys, and they would play their new records, their new product there. So there was an Irishman named Ronan O'Reilly who had heard about offshore radio stations on ships in international waters off the coast of Sweden and Norway, Radio Nord and Radio Sud. And the way Ronan O'Reilly had heard about it was that there was an Australian guy named Alan Crawford in London who had a record label called Carnival Records, and it was all West Indian music, blue beat and ska as it was then. And he couldn't get any airtime anywhere, not on the BBC, didn't have the money to buy airtime at Radio Luxembourg. So he thought to himself, hey, this is not a bad idea, put a radio station on a ship off the coast of England in international waters, we'll make a fortune. But he didn't have a fortune to buy a ship. So he went to this Irishman named Ronan O'Reilly, who had a lot of influential friends in the business district of London, in the city, as they call it, and gave him his idea. And what he didn't realize was that Ronan would steal his idea, as well as funding Radio Atlantis, as Alan Crawford wanted to call his radio station. Ronan O'Reilly went off on the side and started Radio Caroline, named after Caroline Kennedy, JFK's daughter. So April 1964, the first radio station on a ship on the air off the coast of the UK, pirate radio, was Radio Caroline, closely followed by Radio Atlanta. There they were, a mile and a half from each other, these old clunky ships with these huge antennas on them. And they had hundreds of thousands of listeners because nobody wanted to listen to the BBC. The problem with the BBC was they had to deal with the music unions since the beginning of radio in the UK, where they would only play a teeny percentage of recorded music. And when they wanted music in shows, they had to have live musicians there. Musicians union. So, April 1964, suddenly these commercial pop radio stations appeared and pulled in hundreds and hundreds of thousands of listeners.
How did you get this job?
I'd always been interested in radio. I was the first kid on my block to have a tape recorder. and I played radio. My dad was a Canadian in the British Army. He was based in Fayed on the Suez Canal in Egypt. And there was a Forces Broadcasting radio station there, Forces Broadcasting Service. And the station manager there thought it would be a really neat idea that on Saturday mornings, they would have a kid's request show. And they needed a kid to host it. And my dad and the station manager were members of the same amateur dramatics group in the military. And this man asked my dad if he knew any kid who would like to host a kid's request show on Saturday mornings. And my dad said, yeah, I think I know somebody. Came home and asked me, and I said, nah. No, I didn't. I jumped at the opportunity. So I did. I did that for 6 months. Huh? And that was my start in radio. I was in the military myself, worked for a couple of Forces Broadcasting Service stations while I was in the military. Eventually, got discharged from the military in 1963, the fall of 1963. Spent a while working for the Automobile Association in London. And then one day, I woke up and was messing about with the radio, and suddenly there was this station that I never heard before playing outrageously good music. Hmm. And at the end of one of the songs, the guy who was on air said, this is Simon D, this is Radio Caroline. If you'd like to work on this station as a disc jockey, make a demo tape and send it into 6 Chesterfield Gardens in Mayfair in London, and good luck. And immediately sat down with my tape recorder and made a demo tape. That was on a Sunday. I did my overnight shift at the Automobile Association. So there I was. I had this demo, and I thought to myself, shall I mail it? Or, I know, I'll take it in, because Caroline House, the headquarters, was just around the corner from where I worked. So I did. I showed up there after my overnight shift, sat on the doorstep, and about a half an hour went by, and this guy showed up. And he said, hello, what are you doing here? And I said, please, sir, I've got a demo. Oh, you do? Well, come on up. He said, come into my office. Played my demo, and he said, yeah, that's not bad. And as he said that, the phone rang. He picked up the phone, and he said, oh, that's too bad. Hang on a minute. Put his hand over the mouthpiece and said, can you drive a Gates board? And I said, yeah, of course. What the heck is a Gates board? He said, can you go out to the ship? We need somebody out there. The only guy who can drive the Gates board has been taken off by the Coast Guard. He's got appendicitis. And I said, I didn't even pause. I said, yeah. So he said, hang on. He said, okay, I've got a guy here. He knows how to drive the board. We'll have him out there shortly. And an hour later, after a helicopter ride, an hour and a half, I was lowered down onto this ship with this enormous 175-foot steel antenna with wires running up the side. And 10 minutes later, I was sitting driving the board because nobody knew how to. The other guy who knew how to was on his week off. We did 2 weeks on the ship and 1 week off. So there I was, out in the North Sea, 3.5 miles off the coast of England, working on a pirate radio station, driving this board. It was an interesting experience the first few days out there. I worked basically from the time the station signed on until it signed off at 8 o'clock in the evening. Because there was nobody else. The guys who were there all had beautiful voices, but didn't know any of the technical stuff at all. And the reason I knew was because I had worked as a young guy in the Army working for Forces Broadcasting. All radio boards are basically the same. You just have to figure out which piece of hardware is plugged into which fader, or a big knob, as they were in those days. And I ended up working on doing a show as well as driving the board. I had 28 million people listening to me.
Wow.
And that, I think within the first week, I was doing the early morning show, the breakfast show, if you like. And at night, when the station closed down, they would shut off the transmitters, and we had radio engineers on board, obviously, and studio engineers. Usually they were one and the same. And at 5:30 in the morning, the engineer would turn on the transmitter and then would come down to my cabin and shake me in my bunk and say, "Errol, you got 20 minutes. "Yeah, okay." Back to sleep I'd go. 10 minutes later, shake, shake. "Errol, you got 10 minutes. And then he'd turn on the speaker, because all the cabins, there were speakers everywhere from the control room. And at 6:02, he would play the station sign-on, which was this.
This is Radio Caroline South. It's 6 a.m. Good morning. And so it went. But those, you know, from the time I heard that playing, I was asleep. It was a mad panic, throw on a robe over my pajamas, run through the saloon, grab a coffee, sit down at the microphone just in time, to sit and do the opener. Oh. And many's the time I did my show in my robe and my slippers. It was radio. Who knew? Yeah, we spent 2 weeks on the ship and 1 week off. That's if the weather was good, because the ship stayed anchored there. And this enormous trawler, the offshore one, was our link with civilization. And she would come out about every 3 or 4 days and bring out diesel fuel for the generators, which we needed for the transmitters and the studio and the lighting and everything else on the ship. And the mail, and there was a staggering amount of mail before the days of internet, you know, no telephones. So that was the way that people communicated with us. We would get sackfuls of mail, at least a dozen sacks every time that the tender came out. And then food and water and cigarettes and beer. They gave us 2 beers a day, which was very nice of them, and free cigarettes because everybody smoked. And that's if the weather was good. And at the end of 2 weeks, you'd be constantly listening to the weather forecast toward the end of your 2 weeks out there to find out if the tender was going to make it out in time and you were going to get off in time. You know? If not, you were there and you were stuck until the weather got better, sometimes 5, 6, 7 days over your 2 weeks allotted time. And the guys who were supposed to come on and take over were stuck in Harwich, which was our port. the harbor that we went into on the tender. And they would be stuck there in a hotel. And the weather was miserable and there was nothing to do in Harwich, you know. So that was the way we did things out there. The food was wonderful. We had a chef cook chef, a galley boy, a steward who cleaned up the saloon, ship's engineer, a couple of crewmen, and a captain. You had to have that. You had to have a minimal crew there. And these, I mean, they were all Dutch, the crewmen. I learned a lot of dirty words in Dutch, which I've repeated to a couple of Dutch people. Oh, yeah, you know some Dutch? And I'd say, yeah, and go, blah, 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 and they would go white. Well, you sound like a sailor. Yeah, I learned it from a sailor. Yeah, so there we were. And, you know, that was our life. 2 weeks on, 1 week off. When we, on our week off, we would be booked to go and do personal appearances in clubs and ballrooms as they were in those days. And we had a, you know, great life. I didn't live at home. I lived, all my stuff was in storage and I stayed at a showbiz hotel in London, like all of us did. Mm. And that was our life for a couple of years.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
So what was happening when the weather was really bad?
As I'd said earlier, you know, these guys with these wonderful voices, nobody asked us if we were good sailors or not. And when the weather got really, really rough, these guys with the beautiful voices did Technicolor yawns everywhere. You know, it was ugly. I remember one day, our control room, we had a small studio and a control room, and I like to work in the control room because I like to drive my own show. But I remember one day I'd done my shift in the morning and the weather was really, really rough. And two guys, one after the other, went into the control room to do their shows. And in the early days of Caroline, the chair was on wheels and the microphone was on a boom. So when the ship pitched and tossed, the boom would go one way and the chair would roll the other. You know, it was impossible. When it got rough, we would put pennies on the tone arm. That was the arm on a turntable where the stylus was that sat on the record. And we put these English pennies. There were two or three or four pennies just to hold that arm down on the record while the ship was bouncing around. And there were times, occasionally, that we couldn't play records. And then we would resort to tapes that we'd put together. But all our commercials came out on reels of tape, all in order. There was a studio in Caroline House. That's how the company made money, was the way radio does here, and television money, yeah. Commercials. And we all really got on well together. You know, we had a good time out there. We were all a bunch of young guys, and the work wasn't too hard, and there was lots of time to read. And when the weather was beautiful, up on the top deck, laying in the sun and playing guitars and just having a blast. And one of our sponsors was the News of the World, which was one of those sort of raggy kind of newspapers, still is in the UK, and the way we used to get the script for the News of the World was that it would come over an illegal two-way radio system, and somebody would be up on the bridge and write the script down either late Saturday night or really early in the morning on Sunday, and that it would be typed up, and then there would be one copy of it, and that was what was used to read the commercial live. And one of our favorite things to do with new guys on board, and it's, hey, you read this live copy. Uh-huh. So they'd be reading the script, and somebody would sneak into either the control room or the studio with a lighter and set fire to the top of the script as he was reading it. And so There would be this mad dash to get all the words out before the script completely went up in flames. Our transmitter, we had 50,000 watts. Well, not in those days. We only had about 10,000 watts. But RF, radio frequencies, when you're standing real close to a transmitter, are strong enough to light up a fluorescent light tube. There was a stash of light tubes down in the hold. We found these and took them out on deck one night and held them up to spell a rude word, you, toward the shoreline. Don't know if anybody ever saw that, but we certainly tee-heed about that a lot. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Was BBC pretty pissed off at
Much, yeah. You have to remember that there was only BBC and Radio Luxembourg. BBC had the light program when they occasionally played records. A lot of it was because of the Musicians Union live music. And all the bands of the time would come in and do live from the studio floor. In fact, a lot of those early sessions are available online now. So there was the light program, there was the home service, which was sort of very dry, and news magazines and news and pretty dull stuff for a 15 or 16 year old and for a lot of 20s and 30 somethings. And then there was a home service, which was classical music. And then there was Radio Luxembourg, but that was it. There was no commercial radio in the UK at all, which is why the pirates became so popular so fast. We were accused of interfering with all kinds of other radio stations, including Vatican Radio, Rome, which was the most powerful transmitter in Europe. But, I mean, we were a little 10,000-watt radio station. How could we possibly interfere with Vatican Radio? And they made claims that we interfered with rescue frequencies and airline frequencies. I mean, it was just nonsense, but it was BBC constantly prodding the government to do something about us. So I was with Caroline both north and south, I guess for a year or so, and then in 1966, an American outfit, which was funded by Cliff Radio in Dallas, Texas. Lyndon Johnson's wife, Lady Bird, was one of the board members there, decided that they would bring the American style of radio to the UK. So I got hired on there real early on Swinging Radio England. And that ship was unique in that it had two radio stations on it. One was a top 40 radio station, and the other was Britain Radio, hallmark of quality. And they played a lot of really middle-of-the-road Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee, you know, Bert Kampfert, popular music, as it was called then. So there I was, switching allegiances from Caroline to Radio England, and being this yelling, screaming, crazy maniac on the radio, which was the style of radio back in the 60s. If you ever heard Wolfman Jack and all of that stuff, that's style of radio. In fact, I have a clip. Sadly, after about 7 months working there, the Americans decided Radio England wasn't making enough money for them, so they decided to switch from English to Dutch. And Swinging Radio England became Radio Dolphin. And sadly, I lost all of my memorabilia, tapes, everything on my last night in London. I was visiting friends. They took me out to dinner. I left my sample case with all my stuff in it in their apartment. And their apartment was burgled, and my sample case disappeared. And fortunately, there were kids out there with tape recorders who liked to record the pirate radio stations. So I actually have a recording of my last show on the last day of Swinging Radio England.
Let's hear it.
And remember, this is a home recording, you know, and gone down many generations on deteriorated tape since 1966.
Now more music now. The sound of the pleasure is bringing us back out of the Boss Cafe with a little old touch of Music City. Thanks very much to Phil Martin for the news. It's 18 minutes past one. I tell you, hey, Kelly, are you still listening? I've just written a little song in your honor. It goes, we all live in a coffee hovercraft.
a conky hovercraft, a conky hovercraft. Not said, yes? Okay, buddy. Hey, Charles, this one for you.
What a drag he's getting old.
Hey! Yes, that's the Rolling Stones for Mark and Johnny, yes.
Mm-hmm. We all live in a cookie, hot dog.
Davis group there, and yes, keep on running. A song there for Richard Kimball and all that sort of stuff. Ah, friends everywhere, you know. You're listening to the Bobcat Bruce Show from Spring and Radio Moon from the last day of the English language transmission. Yes, indeed!
On every tree that's a bird.
Oh, God, God, on every tree that's a bird.
The song of love.
The owl flies, that's take a shot of weather time. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Cloudy with widespread drizzle and light rain this evening and tonight. Only in the north will there be any bright intervals, and these will only be isolated. Temperatures will fall tonight to about 38 degrees Fahrenheit and rise tomorrow to about 52 degrees. Good night! Good night, wonderful! Ah, yes, me. And guess what Bruce has done? He's been sat here happily singing away, and he's going to put a restaurant on. You ever felt foolish? I do. Hang on a minute. Let's see what I got down on the floor. That's another good show. Oh, yes, I know what we're going to play. Yes. As a now thing, 43,000 particles, but we all live in a conking of a car. In a conking of a car. In a conking of a car. Okay, we got a record on now. Eyes red face underneath panel, feeling a rat twitch, an electric one. They be dozy, beaky, big, and six things. Hold tight. Let's go! Yeah, baby, dozy, beaky, big, and six, a little old touch, a whole tight. 10 before 2 on the Bobcat Blue Show, the last one on Spring and Radio England. So there you go. And I tell you what, it's all happening for the boys out here. Some of us are going to move next door to Brenda. That's me and one of the other guys. You've all heard of the Uppercut Club, the biggest disco play in the country, yes, which Billy Walker is opening. It's called the Uppercut. And if you go down there in 2 weeks' time, you'll see down there Roger Day, Bill Berry, and Bruce Wade. So it's all happening for all the guys out here, I tell you. Yes, indeed it is. And it's no cheerful goodbyes because we're all or something like that. It's here on this piece of paper. Anyway, we've got another record going out here. This goes out to be from Charles, okay? Let's go.
Go, go.
Charles said, what's your favorite record? So I said, Bobby Goldsboro. Voodoo Woman.
Sun up in the sky. Me out of my mind.
Sweet is romance. Hey, Kelly, use all three. As the sound of Judy Walker and the All Stars going out to all Pussycat Club members everywhere. How sweet it is to be loved by you, and only you, I tell you, lovely.
Bill Bob Berry, F-R-E, Swingy, Radio England, broadcasting 4.5 miles off the Britain Essex coast on 227 meters, 24 hours per day, in excess of 50,000 watts of power. S-R-E, first and foremost, is Bob.
Bob, 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 Ray.
for music.
Pow! Bobby, come stop. Let's stop.
And I would come off the air absolutely exhausted, hollering and screaming like a lunatic. But that's what that was, you know, and back in them days. Sorry about the recording quality, but it's the best there is.
That's great.
The reason I kept singing We All Live in a Khaki Hovercraft, a friend of mine who was in the British Army, he was a captain. On my last trip ashore just a few days beforehand, I had had dinner with he and his wife, and he told me that he'd just been handed this hovercraft that was his command.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I kept going on about Kelly and We All Live in a Khaki Hovercraft. And Yellow Submarine had been out a little while and was
kind of fit nicely there.
So there I was, 23 years old, and doing all of that insane stuff on the radio. And then it all, of course, came to a crashing end. Because the British government finally figured out a way of closing us down. They had sent Navy ships to go screaming past us within about 4 feet and trying to, you know, upset the apple cart. We had had a boarding party once come on board and steal the frequency control crystals out of the transmitters. Oh, and we were off the air for a couple of days because of that. And that wasn't any of the other pirate stations. That was obviously an agency of the British government. So eventually they passed a white paper, a bill in the Houses of Parliament that made it illegal for any British subject to work for them, for the pirates, any British company to advertise with them, any British record company to provide them with music, and any tendering company, British, to supply them with anything British. No British food, no British cigarette. And most of the pirate radio stations complied. We had a deadline and all shut down on that particular day, except Caroline that kept going. They went off to the coast of Holland. Eventually, what the British government also did was extend territorial waters from 3 miles to 12 miles, which put us out in the middle of just ugly, ugly water. At least where we were originally was pretty sheltered. And then there was that movie that came out a while back.
Yes, I was going to ask
Radio,
you about that.
Which was just, there were two things that were true about that movie. There was a radio station on a ship and the music that they played in that time. What they didn't get was the rights for the Beatles, you know, but for everything else, they played it. And the rest of it was just nonsense. There were no wild sex parties, no drugs, lots of rock and roll. I watched about a half of that pirate movie. Somebody sent me a pirated copy of it before it was released in North America. I got a halfway through and couldn't stand to watch anymore. And what was really disappointing for a lot of the former pirate radio disc jockeys was that the producers of that movie had talked to a lot of the former pirate disc jockeys and got the story, or a lot of stories. They didn't use any of it.
Yeah, well, that happens all the time.
And they Hollywoodized it, and now nobody's going to do a real story about the pirate radio stations.
It's unfortunate.
It was just garbage. It would have been a much better movie and much more interesting and lasted a lot longer in the movie theaters and sold more DVDs if they'd done the real story.
The real story, of course. Well, that happens so often with so many.
Just idiocy.
Everything has to become Hollywood, right? So what was your call name on the shows?
My on-air name was Errol Bruce.
I
just dropped the nap.
Oh, okay.
Part of that, too, was when I went into the Army following my dad's footsteps. He was a Canadian British Army Sergeant Major. And I went to so many schools and we got shuffled around the world that the only way I survived in school was I was constantly the new guy, but I was the class clown always. And I never did any work because there was never any consequences for me, except that when I was 15, I got streamed out of school and my dad, being the sergeant major, said, well, you have a choice. You can go into the army or you can go into the army. So I went into the army at 15 as an army apprentice and was in the Royal Signals. So when I went into the army at 15, some idiot clerk or clock somewhere had typoed my last name. And it was on all the documentation when I arrived. To my horror, I discovered my name was Crap. K-R-A-P-P. Instead of K-N-A-double-P. so for the, until it got changed, the first 3 months I was in the Army, everybody called me crap. And you couldn't answer back because you were just a junior, you know, and you couldn't correct sergeants. So when I started in radio, I thought, I'm just going to drop the nap and just use my first two names, Errol Bruce. And that's the way I was, Boss Cat Bruce, and, you know, back in them days.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's L-E-P-I-N-G-O, lapingoproducts.com.
What did you do after you were up?
After pirate radio? I traded for quite a while on being a former pirate disc jockey. Did a lot of clubs and guest disc jockeying in ballrooms, and eventually ended up partners in a club in Portsmouth in England, Royal Navy Town. Actually in Southsea, which is a suburb of Portsmouth. There was a club there called the Birdcage. And my partner was Ricky Farr. His dad was Tommy Farr, who was a heavyweight boxing champion right after the war in the UK. Well, and before the war, he was the only guy who knocked down Max Schmeling, who was Hitler's boxing champion. Ricky and I met up and decided that we would run the Birdcage Club in Southsea, but call it Brave New World after the Aldous Huxley book. Spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing that place up. Our business partners ran a couple of bingo halls and made a lot of money, put a lot of money into this beautiful, beautiful club. And Ricky had been around the showbiz scene for many, many years, as I had. And we booked some amazing acts into Brave New World. One of the first big ones was The Who. Brian Auger and Julie Driscoll and the Crazy World of Arthur Brown and Pink Floyd and in the early days of those bands. And then I thought, I'll try and get into BBC, and couldn't. BBC, not so much now, but in the early days of when the pirates were closed down and they had switched over, they called it Radio One. You had to submit your shows in triplicate, scripted, every word you were going to say on the radio and timed out. And it was like, I don't want to do this, but I want to work radio. My mother and dad and my sibs were in here in Canada already. So I thought, I'm just going to go to Canada. So I sold up my shares in the club for an airfare and arrived here in 1968. Yeah, and ended up working in Canada. The first hockey commentator, the live game caller, was Foster Hewitt. And Foster Hewitt had a little AM station here, CKFH, as in Foster Hewitt. And Keith Hampshire, who had worked on Caroline as well, was already here. He was on air there, put in a good word for me. It took me a couple of months to get in to do the all-night show there because I talk funny, so I was told. And the all-night show was an R&B show, R&B and blues. And so there I am on the radio talking about R&B and blues, and the brothers are calling me saying, how come you know so much about our music, man? Because I was on Radio Caroline and broke all the Stax and Volt and Atlantic and Motown music that happened in Europe way before it happened in North America. So anyway, so I worked for CKFH, got a little involved with somebody who broke my heart. She did the last tobacco commercials in Canada before there was a ban on cigarette advertising. And she had gone down to Acapulco and they had shot this very tall, very beautiful young woman walking along the beach, Silver Beach, with this gray horse. And not only did they do the commercials, I could avoid those, but everywhere I went in the city, There she was, on the back of buses, bus stops, billboards, newspapers. And she had come back from Acapulco and said, I don't want to be with you anymore. And I went, oh, no. And that was my first heartbreak. So I ran away to Tucson, Arizona, along with an American disc jockey who was also working at CKFH, Gene Thayer and his Hawaiian wife, Mary Ellen. They had a little notchback VW. We rented a U-Haul trailer, threw his record collection in, my record collection in, and we headed for Tucson, Arizona. And we arrived actually in Tucson, Arizona, the day that Get Back hit the airways in Tucson, and the disc jockey on the radio as we were driving in at sunrise was all like, here's a brand new one by the Beatles, Get Back. And it's JoJo left his home in Tucson, Arizona. So I always said, well, I arrived in Tucson the day that JoJo left. You know? It was my story. Had a wonderful time down there, worked for some American radio stations. Back in 1969, you know, they'd heard some of them on the radio and the TV, but they'd never had a live one among them. It's talking like this. So I had a wonderful time down there. Eventually, I was talked into coming back to Toronto to run John Lennon Yoko Ono's Peace Station radio network. I was their network coordinator. That was right around the time of the bed-in for peace. Billboard and Cashbox had offered them a full-page free ad, and so they decided that they would have a Peace Station radio network to tie in with the Toronto Peace Festival, because they lent their names to having a Toronto Peace Festival after Pop 69 in 1969, where John played with the Plastic Ono Band, and Yoko was in a bag yowling on stage. But anyway, so they did the Bed In for Peace, and then they decided that they would do the Peace Festival here in Toronto, and so they put an ad in Billboard and Cashbox, and they got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of radio stations who wanted to be part of the Peace Station network. They needed somebody to do it. So, because I had known them from my army days at the Star Club in Hamburg, where we used to go when I was in the army, and there was this Liverpool band playing there before the days of Ringo, there was Stuart Sutcliffe and Pete Best at the Star Club. Anyway, so, managed to organize that, but then all the crazies started coming out of the woodwork. In Toronto, the Martians were coming in their spaceships, and which is interesting in view of the things that Tom and I ended up doing together.
That's right.
Anyway, it all blew up in the organizers' faces, and John wrote Instant Karma, because the name of the production company for the Peace Festival here was Karma Productions. Instant Karma is going to get you. Was the song that he wrote after the Peace Festival blew up. And then after that, I did a lot of corporate showbiz. And then in 1994, I got involved with UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was an interesting how you and I met.
Very. So let's hear the story now.
Well, I had gotten my first computer was an Atari. And I had spent $800 on buying a modem to go online with my little Atari computer. And that was at a time when it wasn't the Sightings TV show. What was the name of that TV show? Anyway, it covered the CARP incident, the so-called UFO landing outside Ottawa in Canada. And a woman had called a friend of mine and asked him if he knew anything about, because she knew he was online, and did he know anything about UFOs and what had happened outside CARP, and he said no, but I have a friend in Toronto who probably be able to help you out. And she was calling from Ottawa, where I was at the time she made the original call to my friend Michael. And so when I got back, I found a voicemail from Michael explaining about this woman and asked if he could give her my number and to talk about what I knew about UFOs and the CART case. And all I knew was what I'd seen on Unexplained Mysteries. Unexplained Mysteries back in 94. So anyway, she called me. We had this long discussion. I told her what I was reading online on the old bulletin board networks back in those days, before the days of the internet. And when we finished our conversation, she said, I have a friend in Toronto who might be interested in speaking to you. And all of this happened the morning that I flew off to Ottawa to shoot video. I had read the MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network's bulletin board system, and said, oh, when I come back, I have to get in touch with MUFON. So all of these phone calls went down. She said, I have a friend. Do you mind if I give him your number? And I said, no, not at all. And 5 minutes later, 72 hours after I had said, oh, I have to get in touch with MUFON, the phone rings and this voice says, hi, I'm Tom Theofanis. I'm the director of investigation with MUFON Ontario. Boy, put it out to the universe and sometimes it comes back at you real fast. Yeah. And that's how Tom and I met back then. And Tom has been my UFO mentor for years and years and years. And as a result of meeting Tom, I set up a BBS, a bulletin board locally in Toronto called UFO Updates, which grew like Topsy and became on the web probably one of the premier email lists about UFOs. The original, I think, email list.
Original, for sure.
And I'm still doing that UFO stuff today. I did 8 years at two of the major talk radio stations in Canada, one in Montreal, one in Toronto. 8 years of UFOs, Strange Days Indeed. Have a website called virtuallystrange.net, which will take you to the UFO Updates email archives and a lot of the work that Tom and I did together back in them days.
Mm-hmm. So how many years has it been now since the UFO Updates started?
I started it as a BBS in late 1995. So 95. It's been 15 years.
Because the internet has only started, what, in 96, 97?
No, it had started by then, but it took me a long... I didn't want to buy myself a PC.
PC.
Because I had a beta video recorder in the early days, and it became obsolete and went to VHS, and I didn't want to get involved with anything that was going to be obsolete again. Yeah, it's astounding how far the technology has come. Tom and I are sitting in my little recording studio, and this program is being recorded on a netbook, a little tiny 10-inch screen with all of the a $300 machine and a few pieces of software, and 10, 15 years ago, to do what we're doing now would have cost $500,000.
In a huge studio.
Yeah. And now we're sitting in my basement with a couple of microphones and a mixer and this. It's astounding how it has all come down to you being able to listen to us nattering away here. Well, mostly me. Tom's grinning and smiling a lot and nodding.
Tell us some of the more interesting cases or some of the interesting stories that you heard during your radio days here with UFO Update.
I think probably my favorite one is the O'Hare International Airport incident, where there was this enormous disc that was hovering over one of the terminal buildings there and was seen by all kinds of ground crew. A gray day, this thing was hovering at a couple of hundred feet over one of the terminal buildings. While they were watching it, it suddenly shot up through the clouds, punched a hole in the cloud where you could see the blue sky through that circular hole in the clouds. That's one of my immediate favorites, I think, the one that comes to mind. Oh, it was some sort of weather inversion.
Well, there's always an explanation, right?
Yeah, it's either swamp gas or it's Venus or it's weather balloons or flares from aircraft. Or nighttime parachute jumpers, or Chinese wedding lanterns.
There's always an explanation.
In the Malmstrom Air Force Base, and the day that UFOs appeared over the missile launch sites at Malmstrom in, what is it, Minnesota?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly the missiles went into countdown mode for no reason, other than a UFO being reported hovering over the silo by the guards, the sentries that were up there. went into countdown mode and then fortunately didn't launch, but shut down. And the only way they could get them to restart was to bring in the technicians who spent several days getting them back up and running. Yeah, and that was a weather inversion. And that was Venus, and that was swamp gas, and Chinese wedding lanterns floating in the sky. Yeah.
Did you hear of any real interesting stories locally here?
In
Toronto area?
In the Toronto, Ontario area. Well, you remember that the night we were having a MUFON meeting back in, what was it, 1996, 1997? At Young and Eglinton in Toronto.
Yep.
And one of our MUFON members was looking out of the window of my apartment and said, look, what's that? And several of us got up and said, oh, that's nothing. That's just contrail. It was like a series of backslashes in the sky. And we went back to our meeting. And about 10 or 15 minutes later, Sue said, no, that ain't no contrail. And we looked at, to the west. And there, beyond the approach way to Pearson International Airport here in Toronto, there was this bright light shining toward us. And so we all rushed out onto the balcony and spent a long time trying to make video of it with a little handy cam. And the crescent moon was setting. I mean, it was up there for, what, an hour and a half? The crescent moon sort of set around it. The light eventually went out, and you could still see a smudge outline of a disc. And it was a long way away. When you talked to the air traffic control radar, they didn't have anything on their radar. And they went back and looked at the recordings. Nothing there. And the sun set, and this thing just disappeared into the gloaming, into the darkness. And that was the same night that TWA 800 was shot down or went down or blew up off Long Island in New York. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very strange days. Indeed.
Well, our time is almost over. I want to thank Errol Bruce Knapp for being a great guest and giving us some great information. And we'll talk to you again next time.